Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in to another episode of Pattern Recognition, a show that connects the dots that lead to good business decision making. I'm your host, John Hu, growth equity investor at Norris Venture Partners and former investment banker at Goldman Sachs. So before we get started today, I just wanted to ask a quick favor of you, and that if you are enjoying the show, I would greatly appreciate if you could take 2 seconds to leave a rating and review. And in return, I promise you that this podcast will never, ever have ads that you'll have to skip through. But getting back to the podcast, I am very excited to announce Jake Schwartz, the CEO and founder of General Assembly, as today's podcast guest. Now, for those of you who are unfamiliar, General Assembly is one of the pioneers in the field of alternative higher learning, specifically providing coding boot camps to help bridge the gap between the increasing demand for software engineering talent and the limited pool of engineers out there. Now, what's so challenging about addressing this problem is that maintaining quality student outcomes at scale gets really, really difficult. It's one thing to teach a single class on Python, but it's a whole logistical operation if you're trying to build a business that teaches thousands of classes globally, where not only do you have to continually grow your student pipeline, but you also have to maintain your academic rigor across a wide variety of domains, all while keeping very large employers happy with their candidates. And so in today's episode, Jake and I dive deep into the operational complexities of maintaining quality student outcomes at scale. But first, we start with his entrepreneurial journey broadly, focusing on his own pain point teaching himself to code and how that actually manifested into the inspiration behind General Assembly. We also discuss the key KPIs he gauges to drive the health of the business, as well as his reflections in GA's successful exit to Adecco. So why don't we get started? Hey, Jake, how's it going? Thank you for taking some time today.
Hey, pretty good. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah. So why don't we start with a little bit of your career story and how you came to found General Assembly?
Yeah, well, you know, those things actually go hand in hand, and that, my, you know, my career story actually starts and I grew up in Portland, Oregon, or actually more accurately, when I was a kid, I grew up on a farm about 40 minutes outside of Portland, Oregon. And then we eventually moved to the suburbs. But at that time, you know, Portland wasn't even sort of the hipster mecca it was today. And so it was fairly provincial. And when I got into my first choice college, which was Yale, you know, the sort of perception and what has been told and was signaled to me was like, oh my God, you've made it, right? You've hit the jackpot. You've got the stamp to the gentleman's club, like quite literally, right? The whole thing. And, you know, coming from Oregon, it just seemed like that was, you know, I was going all the way east to this East Coast establishment, to this sort of legendary thing. And then, of course, had a great time at college, like everybody does for the most part. But, you know, when I graduated, really realized that, you know, it was almost like a delusional state where, like, you get this diploma at Yale, and it's all in Latin, this piece of paper, it's like, you can't even read it. And I think it was sort of almost like this delusion of like that Latin, it was like a Harry Potter spell. And it was just good. If I said it out loud, it would open any door I wanted. I would automatically be successful. People would recognize that I was someone they would want to have working at their company or whatever. And then, you know, I got out in the world and realized that with a liberal arts degree and not a particularly grounded worldview yet, I didn't have a lot to add. And there wasn't a lot of, you know, outside of those very traditional tracks of either going to like a professional school or graduate school or going into consulting or iBanking, there weren't many options. And I ended up trying to get in the music business out in LA very briefly, realized that was 2000, Napster was at its height. I remember going to a record label and seeing just empty cubicles as far as you could see. And it kind of clicked for me that I needed to get the hell out of Dodge. Almost went to law school. Thank God I didn't. You know, ended up kind of getting into, I hustled my way into an investment job. And I was doing this thing where I was working and learning about investing during the day. And then at night, I started this nonprofit performing arts space with a bunch of friends. That was really my first entrepreneurial venture. And then I eventually went back to business school just because I felt like I was a mess. I was doing all these different things, you know, lots of projects, lots of interesting stuff. But I had this fantasy that I could sort of consolidate it all together and then maybe get back onto some sort of on-ramp to a career that at least seemed more easy. You know, I had all these friends getting promoted at private equity firms and doing, buying real estate, you know, all that kind of stuff, going on nice vacations. And I was just like, you know, when is that going to happen for me? And when I was at business school, you know, I had done a little more than a lot of my classmates and sort of had thought a little more critically about it. But I kind of realized that business school was this weird middleman, like a toll collector in between sort of lost and lonely 20 somethings like I had been, and companies who were more than happy to show up on campus and interview motivated, maybe slightly smarter because they went to school, people who were ready to go and they could put into a slot. And I realized that, you know, if you think about the cost, both in terms of opportunity cost and direct cost of business school, I was like, this is a very hefty toll. And the reality is all the stuff you learn in business school, like the really important stuff that I actually remember today, happened in the first half of the first semester, right? It's like basic microeconomics, game theory, the four P's of marketing, like literally, you know.
You got really good at drinking though, right?
You get good at partying. I saw some people like really spend it up. You know, I mean, we were in Philadelphia and Wharton, and you see people going out to clubs and buying bottle service like it's, you know, the meatpacking district, you know, sort of pretending, going on these epic world adventures. And, you know, a lot of those people were basically the ones who were like, oh, I'm going into a hedge fund or private equity when I leave here. And then I graduated and it was 2008. And so a lot of those people found themselves 3 months after they had finally gotten that sought after private equity job or that sought after hedge fund role, just get put out on the street. And, you know, I was very lucky in that I was going to be an entrepreneur. I was always planning to be an entrepreneur. But because I had spent some time in the investment world, I could sort of read the writing on the wall that things were not going so great out in the economy. And I had this opportunity to work with this sort of small, multi-stage sort of VC private equity fund, really focused on telecom and tech, and sort of took it as a safe harbor while I could figure out what was happening. And then, of course, Lehman, I think the day I started my job, Lehman was collapsed. Right. And I spent the next 2 years there really like either helping portfolio companies and their CEOs who were really in bad shape because there was no more capital, or, you know, coming up with these incredibly high returning investment theses for the fund, only to find that we really couldn't invest at the time because, you know, there were lots of problems with going and making capital calls. And that was sort of this really key moment for me where I kind of decided, you know what, like, I ended up in a pretty good place relative to some of my peers, but I just couldn't stand the idea that my success in my career was going to be driven by somebody else and their decisions. And I sort of made this call at this point that like that was more important to me than having the nicest apartment or being able to buy bottles at the club or, you know, going on the nicest vacations, that it was much more important for me to say that, like, you know, I lived my life and led my career really being responsible for my own success and taking responsibility for both my successes and my failures. And I don't care if I end up living in a gutter, I am going to be my own boss. And that was sort of the moment where it all changed for me.
That's really wonderful. And I think the realization of, hey, you know, I don't really want to work for someone else's dream, especially someone that came hundreds of years ago, right? I want to go figure out what that dream for myself is or for my team is and go build it. And I think that really resonates with the passion I see across all of the most successful founders.
Yeah, but it's incredibly scary, that moment, right? And it's interesting because that was a moment where I knew so much in my heart, and I was so at the end of my rope that I was willing to listen to my gut, right, and my heart, and not really, you know, my parents thought I was had lost it, I was crazy, and my parents had always been so supportive, right? Like, and it was sort of this weird moment where I just decided no one else could know me better than me, and I was just going to do what made the most sense for me, and I had to have some level of faith that I would figure it out. And that jump was far scarier, even though it was abstract, like, right, there was nothing actually to it, than any of the other entrepreneurial jumps I've ever made. So if you think through, you know, I had had that business school experience, had thought very critically about that and how expensive it was and what value was really being created there. I had gotten out of my undergrad with, you know, such big dreams of the places I would go. And then it would end up, you know, kind of found the real world to be really hard, especially because my parents were in Oregon. They couldn't help me in New York City. They didn't know what was going on. And, you know, I didn't have any uncles who could hook me up with a job that, you know, and so that period felt so lonely and really scary. And I think, you know, now having run GA for 10 years, I can say that, like, I think it's such a common experience for so many people in their 20s and even sometimes in their 30s. And we live in such a culture that's about success and about sort of putting on a happy face so much of the time that it can feel like you're the only one suffering through this sort of identity crisis. Everything I thought to be true isn't true. I have no value to the world. What am I going to be? What am I going to do? And how am I going to pay next month's rent? Right? And you can sort of hear in that the elements that really informed what GA became, which was in a lot of ways just an attempt to build something that would have been really helpful and comforting to the 22-year-old version of myself. And so, you know, I wish everybody could say this, but those hard times really, I now look back on them as being so valuable because they actually helped me get in touch with real problems and really think about how to solve them in a very direct and tangible way.
Mm. And what really resonates to me there is that I'm in my early to mid-20s, right? And in the midst of that existential crisis meets reality situation. And all of my friends and I know that despite the hardship we're going through now to figure out what we want to do with our lives, and as we're searching for our passion and going on that route, it's very much something that will strengthen our resolve later on. But of course, in the present moment, it can be really tough.
And I tell people this all the time, is that it feels at the time that you're somehow falling behind, that you messed up somehow. And again, I can only talk to my own experience and what I've observed. But my perspective now is a lot of my friends that found themselves on a glide path and had a lot of early success and kept getting promoted and got big bonus checks and all that kind of stuff, the crisis still exists with them. It just comes a little later.
Yeah.
And they're less equipped to deal with the uncertainty and ambiguity that comes with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny how the silver platter manifests itself across any life stage, but hardship is indeed how we, at least how I think we grow the most. So then why don't we paint a picture for the audience of the problem you were trying to solve at the time?
Yeah.
And especially because one thing I love about General Assembly the most is that you were really just trying to solve your own pain point. So would love for you to paint more of that picture.
Absolutely. So, you know, the problem, especially at the time when this was beginning, right, the problem that we were looking at was two-sided. One was there were tons of stats, and I had anecdotal experience around me to say that college grads were, on the whole, overeducated and severely underemployed, right? I think it was like close to 40% of them said that the job that they were currently in didn't require a college degree to do, right? There was a sense that most of them wished they had chosen a different major. You know, they had much less optimism than their parents or their grandparents at their age, right, in terms of their economic outlook. And so this was also, especially, remember, we were in New York, this was right after the financial crisis at this point, 2010. And in many ways, the tried and true career paths were falling apart. All of the finance jobs were shrinking. And finance is still around today, but it, you know, it was not the boom time that had happened previously around those jobs. It started to get a lot tougher, a little more dog-eat-dog, right? A little more like layoffs at even high-earning funds. You know, even the legal profession, right? And everything's a lawyer is the, you sacrifice being bored and working too many hours in exchange for a very solid career. That was sort of falling apart because a lot of those big corporate jobs were driven on the backs of billings that they could get from the big banks, and all that was shrinking. And so there was this real moment happening in New York, and I mean, definitely all around. And so the thought was, okay, there's this real craving for that, right? This real craving for how do I get to a career I like? Where do I find that opportunity? How do I switch careers? And that was sort of level one of it. And I had also gone through that by my choice to go to business school. And so that was top of mind. On the flip side, and we saw this partly because people don't know this, but you know, GA's original name was Superconductor. We were a co-working space, you know, and we had all these pretty cool startups. I mean, some of them are still around, you know, SeatGeek, Food 52, Artsy, I'm trying to think of other ones, NewsCred. Like these were all some of our earliest, like, partners in this space, right? They were all around us in their very early days sharing desk space. So it was an interesting time. And what we saw, what I saw very quickly was, you know, when I was asking myself, how do we help these companies grow? The answer kept coming back, talent. You know, there's just not enough. I can't find these people. And when I asked a little more questions, well, where would you find them? And they're like, well, you basically got to poach them. There's no great programs that you can recruit out of. Nobody knows, you know, a lot of these jobs were kind of made up and were, you know, there wasn't a formal definition of them. And so I sort of saw there was like, okay, so I have a two-sided market that both needs something and it seems like they need each other. How do we decrease the friction there? Now, there was another lens I put onto it, which was in this world of education. So we started running these one-night classes out of this room that we had just sort of, by a fluke, decided to call a classroom. And what happened in that room was like, you know, we would let anybody teach a class. And we thought all the startups would take classes from each other. And it would be like this sort of like startups teaching startups, like this magical little utopia thing. What we found, sort of obvious now that you say it, is that nobody at a startup has time to take a class, right? They want to go home, right? But the general public was fascinated by this. And there was this incredible energy. And so night after night, we were selling out this little space we had. And I looked at that and I said, okay, well, this is cool. It's an extra revenue stream. And if we were just going to try to be a landlord, extra revenue streams are always nice. But it's never going to be a really exciting business. It's not certainly not something we want to go raise a bunch of money around. And I have a hard time seeing how it scales. And it looked to me a lot like one of the things when I had started this art space in my 20s, it looked a little bit like a really bad business model for an off-Broadway theater, where you change the content every night. You can only have 30 seats, right? And you're just hoping people will come. And so I started to go on this sort of, I would almost call it like a walkabout, thinking about why had people, I'd heard a lot over the years in investing that education's a great industry. Why is that? A friend of mine had just written a book called DIYU. Her name's Anya Kamenetz. I helped her a little bit around her first book, Generation Debt. And I read that and we talked a lot about that. And I started to see that there was a couple interesting things going on in the world of education, which we were sort of experiencing this energy, right? It was energy and enthusiasm, but not much else, right? And my conclusion was a couple things. One is people were coming to our space primarily because they wanted to access practitioners and learn how things were actually being done. And there was not a lot of, there's not a lot of other places to go do that, that were up to date. You know, there was a lot of continuing ed kind of, if you wanted to learn like, you know, Java, right? Like development, there's probably a course at NYU on it. But if you wanted to understand what this whole Ruby on Rails thing is all about, or how do you work with APIs and JSON or any of that, there was none of that, right?
Yeah.
And so the sort of theory was, okay, there's a craving for this. It looks a little like, my theory was a little bit like, what people want is to continue learning in a way that helps their career. And there wasn't a lot of stuff out there for it. Now, when I looked at the world of education, what I saw is there was a ton of energy and talk about education innovation. And it's important to say that this is right around the time of the sort of MOOC, the beginning of the MOOC thing, right? Like these online courses, lots of energy. Coursera and Udacity were being founded. edX was, I think, already existed, you know, that kind of thing. And my take on it was is that a lot of the sort of conventional wisdom in the sort of innovation circles, the, you know, Silicon Valley, was that what happened in music and TV and movies and books would happen in education. That it needed, education was going to be Netflixified, and that was the opportunity. And the more I looked at the market, what I saw was, is that people loved, investors loved looking at education because they always talk about the big, it's like a $1 trillion market, right? But what's so fascinating about that is they kept looking at through the lens of content, you know, like a media business. And content was really a small portion of that. Right. And so I sort of took this contrarian view. I said, I'm not going to a class the same way I'm going to a movie just to be entertained, right? Or have a diversion for my life.
Yeah.
And so this idea of I'm charging for seat time seemed a little crazy to me. And yes, of course, if that's all it was, you could totally put it online, make it free or close to free, and you're changing the world, right? But I looked at it and I said, I think what makes education so interesting is it's oftentimes the biggest check that a person ever writes. And if it's not the biggest, it's one of the top three, right? Might be house, might be car, you know, those kinds of things. But like, it's up there. And when I looked at that, I said, the secret of education is it's framed as an investment and it's thought of as an investment. And the interesting thing was that, you know, even at Wharton, it was talked about as an investment, but, you know, most investments, people actually then have to back that up with some numbers, like how does it perform? You know, how is it worked over time? You know, what are the other alternatives? Like all this kind of stuff that wasn't happening in that space. And I realized that if you thought of education as an investment business as opposed to a media business, you'd come to very different conclusions about where the innovation was going to come from. And my conclusion was, is that it was going to come from this big debate that was happening all over society about who pays what, where, when, and why. And so my thesis was, if we could build a program that took someone, didn't entertain them for a night and taught them a little thing, but could actually transform their economic opportunity, take them from point A to point C, that people might be willing to invest. And of course, we were outside of the existing educational system, so we had to provide a much higher return and be much more articulate about it than the sort of usual players, but that there was this interesting opportunity to do that. And so we, you know, the theory was we're going to teach these tech skills because they're not taught that often and they have high demand. And we're going to do it in a much, much shorter period of time. And if you think about that return on investment calculation, you have return on the top, that's a numerator, investment on the bottom, that's a denominator. If you can shrink the investment by, you know, 5/6 and keep the return profile even in the same ballpark, you've essentially 10x'd or more the return on investment. And we could make it much more shorter term. And we basically took this model that has existed forever, which is vocational training, and made it something that made sense for someone who had gone to NYU to participate in.
So the vision at the time was fairly contrarian, right? But you guys have now pioneered it as the norm. But it's much easier to maintain quality with just, say, one class, right? Where you're maintaining 30 seats and you're only teaching introduction to Python. But then as General Assembly has scaled into success, I mean, how have you been able to maintain that same quality of outcomes for students at scale?
There are sort of quippy answers, and then there's the real answer, which is hard work and a lot of operations. So maybe I should go into that a little bit, because I think at one level, I would say you do what you did with that one course 1,000 times, right? That's easier said than done. Because when you double something, it breaks. When you double it again, it breaks again. And you know, and so on and so on and so forth. And it breaks sometimes in a completely different way. And you're all of a sudden dealing with an army of people trying to do this who have their own sort of human variations built into them. And it's not easy. And so I felt like we had to solve that a few different ways. And by the way, there were missteps along the way. There were a lot of fire drills where it was like, okay, all in those very early days, okay, all hands on deck. The person who was supposed to do this totally dropped the ball. We've got to actually like go into high gear and make this happen for our students. Those early days are not easy, and you have to be willing to do that. And because, by the way, when you're dealing with students' lives, it's no joke. And when people are investing in themselves, they take that very seriously. You have to take that equally seriously. And that's one of the things you can't. The whole sort of motto of just disrupt and break things does not work when people's lives are on the line. And I think it's something that a lot of startups today are going to learn those lessons the hard way. Because you have to be cautious. You cannot put the cart before the horse. You cannot be making claims before you've delivered on them, all those kinds of things. And so we were very cautious about that. But in general, I thought there was a few really key elements to it. One is I needed to make sure that there was an information feedback loop between what was actually happening on the ground and what we thought was happening, and made sure that we were getting information in real time and fast enough that A, we could prevent, you know, bad situations happening for any, even one individual student, but more importantly, to make sure that we were adjusting our operational sort of strategy and resource allocation, all that appropriately as frequently as possible. And that alone is really hard, it's not easy. You know, the secret of this is in some ways, what happens a lot of times, even today, our graduates, they're happy, they get a job, but the minute they get a job, we like stop hearing from them. Right. So we don't know if they fell off the planet, if they're like wandering the streets, or like if they're just happy and ignoring us. All right. And I'd love to believe it's all one or the other, but we want to know. And so building in that data infrastructure, that feedback loop, ensured that we could sort of be on a route to continuously improving the model and making it more scalable as we go. I mean, there are other, to be honest, like instructional quality is in some ways even harder. I mean, because, you know, you're dealing with people who are all pretty experienced teaching these courses, have their own careers, or very, you know, we're hiring them for that reason. They all have their own opinions. How can we ensure that there's a relatively consistent student experience where people are getting the same amount of value, whether they're in LA or Singapore? And what I like to say is all of these things are like little mini puzzles. And I choose to always see this a little bit like, with enough time and with enough resources, you can solve most operational challenges. But you have to deploy them the right way, you have to be watching the right things, and you don't have either unlimited time or unlimited resources. So you've got to be really strategic about where you put that energy and time. And so that really, I mean, I know you want like some really big answer to it, but the honest truth is you just kind of do it and you take it seriously. You value all the people that you're hiring to do the work. You empower them to look for issues that you haven't seen yet and ask them to have some autonomy around how they might solve them. You know, these are all sort of the elements when you're trying to build a big organization. And these are the things that people don't always talk about in like, you know, whatever startup school or whatever, right? It's like, that's the part that is so friggin' hard and is where you spend the majority of your hours if you're a successful founder CEO, is solving those problems, tweaking those things in the trenches, fixing stuff yourself, trying to figure out how to get yourself out of the trenches, you know. And, you know, the idea is almost besides the point, right? It's, can you have the endurance and the fortitude and convince enough people to help you on that way to actually stick with a problem long enough to truly get it nailed down?
Yeah, I definitely see everything you're saying there. And I think it goes back to the truism that in order to scale, you have to do things that don't scale.
Mm-hmm. I talk about that all the time. I love that.
So we've actually only talked about what I see as one of your two customers, right? We've only spoken about students, but the other part of your customer equation is employers, because that's the end goal of working with students is to place them with great employers. And so I'd love to hear any sort of strategy you had for landing your first few employers and convincing them that a student graduating from General Assembly had as much credence as a senior graduating from, let's say, Yale with a CS degree.
Again, the answer was try, fail. You know, look, we had an advantage, right? Which is that, and this is, I think, always important, is that I'm sure you've heard the phrase, you know, you're looking for a painkiller, right? And when you're solving a problem that people are actually feeling pain around, it wasn't easy, but I knew that they had that pain. And so they would at least come to the table and talk about, okay, what don't you like about this student? All right, well, how does a student not fit your normal expectations? Are you sure this isn't exactly the person you need to fill this job? We also did a lot of work, including tons of employers in building our curriculum, right? It's a classic strategy, getting buy-in early in the process opposed to the late, right? And so by doing those things, we could get a start. And then, of course, we also have students out there trying, really wanting to get a job too. So they're plowing ahead, you know, in a way, with or without us. And my job was to make sure we're delivering enough value to those students that they will reflect on it and say, wow, GA was a help. Right. If I've done that, we're great. And again, it's been a long time. I mean, really years and years and years and years of having things work, having things break in new ways I didn't even imagine, fixing those things, right? And being as transparent as we could be with everyone about, you know, what our mission is, what our values are, and how hard we are trying. And by the way, at a point, how hard you're trying doesn't matter, right? That your customers at some point, especially the non-early adopters, just want the thing. And I think we're lucky in that. I mean, I just have incredible operators. I've had incredible operators on our team almost the entire journey. And their passion for the mission and their passion for bringing just hard work and analytics and problem solving to bear for the purposes of making sure that we serve our students as best as we humanly can is how it really worked. That's, by the way, one of the, I think, the real powers of a mission based business is that you can harness that energy, and there's a reason to stay up late other than you'll make a bunch of money. And I think that's something I really have benefited from and really value as part of the entrepreneurial experience.
Yeah, that's great. So then now that you guys are at scale, what are some key KPIs you use to track the health of the business?
Oh man, I mean, well, I think one of the things to keep in mind is your KPIs necessarily change, right? Like, and if you're, I mean, it's great if you have, your business is so simple and so strong that you have one KPI and that lasts you forever. I mean, that's amazing, right? But even then, what I find is the journey of KPIs is KPIs are great because it's sort of, KPIs can both be a report card, but they can also be a leading indicator, an alert system. And the way I've always looked at KPIs is I want to keep understanding better and better the leading indicators so that we can anticipate challenges before they're complete disasters. And so, you know, I think in a business, your KPIs at the end of the day, whether you like it or not, if you're going to be a business, at some point your KPIs are revenue and profit. And I always think like those are kind of where it starts. Now, I'm aware there are people out there who really take the attitude that there's a lot of great startups where don't even worry about the money, just get the users, right? Do all that stuff. And if you have that kind of level of volume of activity, you'll figure it out. And I think when you're Facebook, that's true, right? I think of myself more as a, you know, it's mere mortal without just unstoppable growth and millions of data points to use to optimize, that I knew that eventually we were going to have that be right side up, that revenue and profit, all those numbers. And so you start there and then you say, well, okay, then I want, you know, how many students are we getting each day coming in? How many? Then you say, well, students aren't predictive. How about how many applications are we getting? You know, how many applications are, you know, qualified? Are they turning into students? You know, then it was like, okay, how many instructors do we need to hire? Are we staying ahead of that? How many times do we have a fire drill around not having enough instructors, right? It's like all these things. What I would constantly do is at certain times when there were certain types of problems, turn those into a KPI that we watch obsessively. I have a saying, it's not one of our work values, but it probably should be, which is, it's really this idea that of the power of every day. And I have this concept that while your KPIs don't always conform to daily data is useful, the act of watching and thinking about anything every day is basically how our brains were meant to work, right? If you think about like humans on the plains of Africa, right? Like there was not like, oh, I'll get to that next Friday, right? If there was even a concept of Friday, it was morning to night. And why I think that matters is that the things that you do every day are the things that stay top of mind. It allows your creative mind to really work. And whenever you get out of that daily cadence to something more like a weekly or monthly cadence, you're basically not prioritizing it, right? And by the way, there are things I do on a weekly or monthly cadence, but that's where somebody else is worrying about it most of the time, and I'm just checking in. And so my whole theory is if something's really broken or really needs to do something for whatever reason, I want to be talking about it and thinking about it every single day. And so I'll have like, sometimes I'll have two or three, you know, stand-ups a day with different teams around a very specific issue. And, you know, they might feel a little bit like they're in the penalty box having to do these daily meetings, but it becomes a way of actually getting the problem solved. And at some point, the problem is on its way. The people have got it. They're sick of seeing me every day. And it's an appropriate time to stop doing that. But I'm always having at least one or two of those things in my circle because I think it's very rare to do something once a week and make it actually improve.
Yeah, I mean, it completely reshapes your context when every single day you come back to your guiding North Star, that same metric, and ask yourself the question, you know, is what I'm doing serving my purpose?
Right. And sometimes you have to sit in the uncertainty, like, wow, the KPI didn't change at all. We got no new students yesterday. And what I see sometimes is people make the mistake of that meaning, well, then I shouldn't look at it every day. But I think there's an almost visceral, I've seen this myself, I've seen it with other people, where you get this almost visceral relationship with the number and the behavior. You start to understand its ebbs and flows. You get inside of it, right? And you start to feel it, and you have to say, okay, no students for one day is fine. 2 days, I better panic and look for the reasons, right? You start to get a sense of where the sort of tolerance bounds are for it. And if you're not looking at it every day, it takes you much longer to figure out what's going on. And so that's a big thing for me. So now, I mean, we've got, you know, the reality is each team has its own set of KPIs, right? And it's, and I mean, we're complicated. We're probably more complicated than we need to be, right? We've got several different business lines that are totally different from each other. We operate in like 6 or 7 different countries. It's complicated, right? And I'm not sure I would wish that on anyone, but it's just sort of what happened with us. And so, you know, for me, I always try to filter it down to, okay, you know, it starts with, is our revenue on track? Can we predict our revenue? You know, from what it starts, what's our burn, right? I would say one of my best pieces of advice for early stage founders is you should be looking at your burn every day and living with it. And it's when you stop looking at your burn every day that really bad things happen. And I've seen CEOs get fired because they had only 5 months of cash left, you know, started fundraising too late. And, you know, it is one of those like things that is definitely true is like the biggest sin, in some ways, the only sin in a startup world is running out of cash.
Yeah.
Right. That's unforgivable.
Yeah.
And so, you know, understanding that that's your core KPI is a place to start. Then you need to figure out your funnel, right? What's your funnel? You know, it's whether it's revenue or users or whatever, they don't start as dollars or users. They start as something else. And do you understand that funnel? Can you predict it? And then after that, I really like to frankly go to what are the drivers of those pieces of the funnel? What is the thing that you're doing that actually makes more of the thing you want to have happen, happen? Which sounds so stupid, but it's literally like the fundamental truth. Do you understand what's driving your growth? If you did more of X, would more of Y actually happen? Or do you think it would happen? What's the relationship? Is it linear? Is it exponential? Is it diminishing? Like, what's the relationship, right? And I'm surprised how few people all over the business world think in that way, because they're all trained to think in this budget versus actual way. Now, budget versus actual is a totally other great way to look at your business, right? Am I missing or beating, right? The problem with it is when you're growing really fast, it's not missing or beating tells you nothing about the health of your underlying thing, which is, do I have clear drivers that work? You know, am I getting the outputs I think I should have? Do I know the next things to fix? Is it getting better? Budget versus actuals is this weird arbitrary thing that's really driven from a very, very, very large corporate environment of saying, you know, do you understand your business well enough to model it and predict what's going to happen? And then can you manage, you know, the noise? And by the way, I need that mostly so that I can go tell our investors that they can count on our numbers next quarter. It's not an unimportant thing for startups to do. I don't want people to interpret that. You have to do it. And it's informative. It lets you know, do you understand your business or not? But I think driving your business off of budgets or actuals misses the real goal of any startup, which is to grow. And growth is a next level that requires different tools than just budget versus actual. I see people all the time, even in our own company, you know, what happens is, you know, going into 2020, they up their budget in their spreadsheet. They say, oh, we're going to do this much more in revenue next year. And then they think just because they changed the number to spreadsheet, somehow it's just going to magically happen, right?
Yeah, you got to fund the drivers.
You got to know what are you doing? What are the things that you do that make the thing you want to have happen happen?
So we've talked about the granularities of the founder's journey. And one particular aspect of the journey that I think a lot of founders dream about is the exit. Although arguably that should be an indirect consequence of focusing on your customer. So I'm curious if you could share any lessons learned on your successful exit.
Yeah, you know, I am still in the midst of it, right? So I'm still learning as I go. Here's a couple of things I will say first off is that, and I'm a little different this way, which is that I believe you should always be thinking about your exit as a startup founder. Because the reality is once you take venture capital money, it's your only option. I think there's this really bad thing that's happened in VC culture where it's almost taboo to talk about an exit. You know, people think they're VCs, they're not ready to sell, all that kind of stuff. But I actually think it's an almost a moral imperative of the CEO at every board meeting to bring up exit, what the strategy is, what the timeline is, what they see as possibilities, whether or not they think it's a good time, the risks and rewards are for continuing. Because I think if you get in the habit early, you can still make the decision to keep going forever. But if you never talk about it, I see a lot of times where boards and CEOs wait until it's too late, right? They stay at the party too long. And there are just life cycles to these things, and there are times where it makes sense to be part of something bigger. That's number one thought, is like always, and I think you always kind of, I'm always working backwards from your goal, and that's the most concrete goal, and you should be working backwards from that. God bless it if you don't want to exit until you're a $100 billion company. Like, that's amazing. But at least say that and keep reiterating that, right? You know, it helps align everybody in the right way. And you have a fiduciary duty to do the right thing, right, as well. So there's that as well. I would say there's a lot of things that were told to me about exits. One of them is a classic, that startups are bought, not sold. I believe that is not true. Or rather, it might be true some of the time, but it's certainly not true a lot of the time. And if you think about it from the perspective of a big company's M&A person or corp dev person, they have a lot of stuff being thrown at them, right? They're part of this big corporate machine, and they want to stay in their job and they want to be successful at their job. Part of that, like anybody in business, is to make sure they're spending their time on things that will actually happen. And so one of the mistakes I see a lot of people make is wanting to play so hard to get that it doesn't look like you're actually for sale. And what an M&A person is, now, every once in a while, that one, they're like, no, they're just doing that as a negotiation, or we're going to come in with such a huge number that they can't say no. That is rare, right? What's more likely to happen is they're going to say, well, they're not for sale yet, they're not ready, you know, I'm just going to go on to something else. And then you've lost that opportunity. I can list like 10 times that happened to me at GA, right? Like where I thought I was doing the playbook perfectly, and instead I was just telling people to go away. And I didn't know it. I would say the second thing is that if you think about, like, especially when you're a non-profitable startup, right, and you're being bought by a public company, they are buying you for the future, not the past or present. And it means two things. It means that it's really about the relationships and the level of trust you can form, not about how much sort of frantic auction energy you can create. And so I'm always getting calls and helping people sort of negotiate sort of those conversations and as they get further along. And I think one of the real key things is like you're trying to build a relationship built on trust. Now it's hard because you're on the other side of the table, but it means that even more importantly that you behave in a highly credible way. You maintain that credibility throughout. You ask for the things you need and you don't bluff. And you're very authentic about what you want and what you see for the company. Now, that's not all of those things are the ideal state. And, you know, it really, there's so many dependencies and every deal is a little different, right? It's fascinating. I think the other thing is that deals take a lot longer than you think they're going to take most of the time. So you better have some cash and you better be able to walk away. There's nothing worse than not having to have a deal happen because you have lost every amount of ability to actually construct an arrangement that would actually be good for you.
And time is the killer of all deals, right? And I think you'll see founders really struggle to manage a process concurrently with keeping their eyes on the ball with the day-to-day operations.
It was the hardest thing. And I was lucky that I have such a strong team. I have an incredible president, COO, Scott Kirkpatrick, an incredible team. Just all over the business, honestly, you know, from HR to sales, everything like that, that kept things humming while I just kind of went in a hole, right, and tried to figure out what we're going to do. And we're talking to multiple parties and how we're going to manage this and how do I do this with integrity and all sorts of things, right? And now on the other side, I could say it's a whole new journey, right? You're learning, you know, I think we're still teaching our acquiring company that they're very smart. What we actually do and how our business works and how we grow, we are learning how you can and cannot operate in a much larger organization. You know, there's always, I see these pitch decks for deals where it's like, oh, there's going to be so many synergies. Synergies are always take three times as long as you think they are to appear, right? I mean, it's all these kind of things. But, you know, what I'm really happy about is I got lucky. You know, Adecco runs as a global holding company with many brands. They've grown through acquisition for their entire 20 years. So, or 30 years or what. So really what that means is not much has changed, except for say me, who now actually has a boss, the one thing I swore I would never have, right? And, you know, we talk to the executive committee of the company as opposed to a board, right? And that comes with its pluses and minuses, just like my board did. So, you know, in many ways, we're just doing the same things. The dynamics are different, right? We can't just go and say, oh, we're just going to go raise another $50 million, right? We can't do that. It's a very different set of conversations. But on the flip side, there is never a worry that we're going to run out of cash next month or next year. So it's just a trade-off. And look, for me, I think one of the things that, you know, if I'm speaking honestly, like the 30-year-old who was like, you know, I'm just going to leave this business school job and, you know, go do something radical, you know, I did think the exit was the end. And now I'm finding that there's a lot of ways it's not. I mean, one is I'm still here for now, right? But I think the other thing was I found that it's not just about the money. And I spent 10 years slaving over this thing and making sure that it's in a good home, that it is being run with the values and will continue to run with the values that we've tried to instill in it, and that the brand means something 10, 20, 30 years down the road are way more important to me than I think I would have thought when we started this journey. But it's a gift. It's a gift to sort of connect to those things. And, you know, I would say, like, I'm just, you know, from a deal perspective, I'm happy that we made money for all of our investors, right? We made money for all the employees who held equity. We made sure that the brand is going to be around for a long time. I mean, those are the things that I can look back on now with pride, right? Not just the money in my bank account.
Yeah. Those values really resonate as you think about building your baby and watching it grow.
Totally.
So then the last question, Jake, which relates back to the title of the podcast, pattern recognition. Are there any consistent patterns you see across successful ed tech companies?
Yeah, well, I think ed tech is a really funny one, right? Because even ed tech, that's like saying like food companies, right? I mean, there are a million different types of education. I mean, education, are we talking pre-K? Are we talking K through 12? Are we talking private, public, international, US, textbooks versus services versus, right? You see what I'm saying? Like, it goes on and on and on and on. I would say what I see a lot of times is people, there's a couple mistakes that happen in education businesses. One is people mistake a great 30,000-foot logical solution to the problem with an ability to make that solution happen on the ground, right? So there's a lot of idealists and people who want to change the world in education. A lot of investors like that too, who are invest in theoretically great ideas that have a major flaw in how in the go-to-market or, you know, those kinds of things. I think distribution for almost every part of the education infrastructure ecosystem is what makes or breaks your startup. Meaning, how are you going to sell? How are you going to monetize? You know, who's your customer? You know, and one of the things, like you said, like K through 12 is notorious. It's just littered. It's a graveyard of startups. And one of the reasons for it is that it's people's kids. So it's like, you better not screw around there, right? But also, you know, we have, you know, 50 states. Each state has a bunch of different school districts in it. It is a balkanized, it's like a bunch of warlords that you got to go sell your product to. And they don't act in tandem at all, normally. So selling becomes really, really, really hard. And then you have the fact that you have these big companies who have sort of a lock on selling. I liken it almost to wireless carriers. You know, we only have AT&T, Sprint, and Verizon. And, you know, in education, you know, it depends on who's in bankruptcy and whatnot, but like Pearson, Houghton Mifflin, McGraw-Hill, and those guys, their entire business is distribution, right? They have a person who hangs out in that school district for years, just schmoozing with people for when the next textbook order comes. And so you can't underestimate the power of distribution it matters way more sadly in a lot of ways than the product itself. And I think in education, because it attracts so many well-meaning, passionate people, they mistake a good product and a well-meaning set of intentions with a can't-miss strategy in business. And those are just two very, very different things.
Yeah. Any other patterns?
I think another pattern, and this is one that I've learned really the hard way in many ways, is when I started GA, when we started raising money and things like that, I sort of still had this sort of Wharton mentality on investment, that there was like, you know, my Series A, that valuation was a valuation of the actual asset and all these things. It took me a long time to really get what was actually happening, which is that all your investors are looking for is they have a profile of what level of multiple of capital they want to get on their investment. You know, early stage, it might be 10 to 20x is sort of a minimum. Later stage, it's more like 3 to 5x. And what your investors are really doing is working backwards from that, right? And they're saying, here's what I can value you at and still have a pretty good chance of getting my return if it works, right? And I think one of the biggest mistakes that early stage founders make, especially sometimes first time founders, is not having the, I guess it's bravery or courage to describe a vision big enough to inspire investors to actually invest. And, you know, there's a sense of incrementalism that some founders do. I actually think now it might be flipping, where I think now the problem is everybody knows if you show up with a really big total addressable market and a pitch deck, get funded. And that will actually, the game will change, because at some point that really is not going to work and it's going to, but I do think in general, like, the size of vision has its own center of gravity, right? It allows you to recruit the best people, allows you to pay the best people, it allows you to recruit the best investors, it allows you to actually manifest that vision. And so it's almost like this giant flywheel where you need to get it to a critical velocity, and a size of vision really helps with that. And you're going to have to think about that eventually, because if you're successful, you know, there is no funding round or exit event that doesn't also require a story about how you're going to, you know, 10x from there. So it never ends. And so the bigger your market, the more likely you are to be able to tell that story at any point on the journey.
Awesome. Well, Jake, thank you so much for taking the time. Once again, a big thank you to Jake for joining us today. If you enjoyed the show, I'd love if you gave a quick rating and review, as well as sent any feedback or guest recommendations my way. You can also check out show notes and more on the podcast website at patternrecognitionpod.com, and reach me on Twitter at John Heezy, that's J-O-H-N-H-E-E-Z-Y, or on Instagram at John G. Hu. So thank you all for tuning in, and I'll talk to you next week. Bye.